That was Dogen's vow, his expression, his vow and his verse encouraging us to arouse the vow, awaken the vow. Hotsugan mon, the verse for arousing the vow. This morning we chanted the Lotus Sutra. The Buddha expressed a vow, saying, ever making this my thought, how can I cause living beings to enter into the unsurpassed way and promptly embody Buddha? I'm always thinking this. How can I help everyone enter accord with the unsurpassed way and promptly embody their Buddha nature? We were talking about vow yesterday. So I was called to look into the sutra, my favorite sutra, the Sandhidharmochana Sutra, unraveling the mysteries. Maybe difficult sutra, and maybe wasn't always my favorite. But studying this with my teacher for years and years, years of studying this one sutra, I love it. So I think that's what sometimes happens. It doesn't necessarily come right away, right? But with a vow and devotion to study something deeply, it comes alive. So this particular sutra is kind of like an encyclopedia of the Bodhisattva way, I feel. So it's got every topic, of course. There's something on vow. In fact, I knew what page it was on. It's because it's all very structured. This is a section on the Bodhisattva practices, the paramitas, the all-encompassing practices of Bodhisattvas, which are dana, giving, generosity, followed by
forbearance.
Usually listed as third, but that is one of them.
Patience.
Patience is same as forbearance.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's third. How about second?
Ethics.
No. Well, ethics, precepts, morality. So giving, generosity, precepts, ethics, morality, patience, forbearance. Fourth is... well, that's fifth, so that's one of them. Fourth is something we have to practice a lot this week.
Meditation.
That's same as concentration.
Zeal.
Diligence, heroic, enthusiastic effort, virya, followed by concentration or meditation, dhyana or zen, and lastly, prajna paramita, wisdom gone beyond. So we'll keep hearing that list forever. We can't remember that often enough. I think these practices all together combined is just like a well-rounded practice of the Bodhisattva way. Everything's included. I think if we're wondering, if we forget, what's the practice again? What is it again? Well, it's these six practices of the Bodhisattva. And if they're all working together, that's the complete path. And yet, there's many other teachings, right? And sometimes the Buddha even taught 10 paramitas. So this sutra is one where he teaches the six like that. And then he adds in these other four that are assist the first six. So he lists it as six, but then there's four kind of subsidiary ones.
It strikes me that one of those, concentration or meditation, encompasses all the others. Because if you meditate regularly, your ethics go become refined. And you become more patient. So I know they're in themselves, they are helpful, but
you must be feeling that. You might feel this week that meditation is the heart of it because that's what we're doing this week. But I think you could say that about any one of them. If you practice giving completely, that includes meditation because it's like giving away your past and future to rest and meditation in the present. And giving is also practicing ethics and enthusiasm and patience. So I think you could take any one of them and say it includes all of them, actually. But I can see why you'd say meditation this week, because this has to include all of them.
Like if you take patience, you can't really be patient until you get rid of all the stress in your nervous system. And that comes with meditation.
But you could say the other way around, that you can't really get rid of all the stress till you're really patient. Patiently accept what's happening. Anyway, I think you could look at it in these various ways. And I think we can take one like meditation and say, let's make that our focus and have them all emerge from that. But we don't get stuck on that. We could next week take up a different one. Anyway, there's these four others. One of them is called vow, the perfection, the paramita of vow or aspiration, pranidhana. And so Buddha kind of defines it in the sutra. And it struck me as this sounds very much like Dogen's vow that we just read, and the feeling behind Dogen's vow about our past evil karma having greatly accumulated. We need to make this vow to deal with that. So the Buddha here says, if there are many afflictions or karmic hindrances in the present state, and bodhisattvas are incapable of cultivation with continuity, our hindrances prevent continuous practice, right? And they have weak wills and inferior aspirations or conviction, and so are incapable of inner mental stability and meditation, and are unable to hear the teachings for bodhisattvas and cultivate good. Therefore, their meditation cannot bring forth transmundane wisdom. So they take in a little bit of accumulation of merit, and truly vow in their hearts that in the present and future, their past harmful karma afflictions will decrease and diminish. This is called the paramita of vow. So they truly vow in their hearts that in the present and future, their difficult karmic hindrances will diminish. It's pretty much what Dogen's saying too. And by this vowing, these afflictions are weakened and diligence can be cultivated. So I say that the paramita of vow is an aid to the paramita of diligence. So each of these last four aid some of the first six in this sutra, and in a wonderful way that they're connected. So this one, vow, is particularly cultivated to aiding the bodhisattva practice of enthusiastic diligence. Yes?
I have a question, and it's about Buddha's and bodhisattva's and ancestors freeing up.
Yeah. You noticed that one, huh?
I understood that. And I know there are, like, masters that claim to be able to cleanse others of their past karma, and that's always seemed pretty bogus. Could you speak about
it? Yeah.
Can you clarify the question?
Oh, the question is in Dogen's verse for arousing the vow that we chant before the talk, he says, may all Buddhas and ancestors who have attained the Buddha way be compassionate to us and free us from karmic effects, allowing us to practice the way without hindrance. So it's like a prayer. It's kind of like invoking them to help us. And yeah, it's an amazing thing to say. I've often thought for Dogen to say. Yeah. I think we can hear it as Buddhas, like, not in terms of like actual people, but like the you know, Buddha nature. You know, we're invoking our own Buddha nature, our own awakened mind, and the awakened mind, which is one with the awakened mind of all beings. We're saying, may that free us from karmic effects, because in fact that is, I would say, what frees us from karmic effects is the free, spacious, compassionate, open awareness of Buddha nature that's, you know, inherently free from karmic effects itself, but it's covered and, you know, obscured by karmic effects. So we're saying, in order to see this, we're like invoking that which is hidden behind the karmic effects to like shine strongly enough that it kind of like shines right through those and clears those karmic effects. Yeah. So that would be Buddhas, but then to say ancestors, to add in ancestors, that's what caught me. Buddhas and ancestors, because ancestors are actual like living beings, you know, that are have Buddha nature. So we might say, we might interpret it like the Zen ancestors who are letting their Buddha nature shine through their life, and they have all these skillful teachings to help us, you know, may their Buddha nature help us, particularly the way of like through their life expression and their teachings. That's how their compassion, even if they're not even alive, right, their compassion still comes to us through the teachings that they left. Sometimes, I mean, I definitely feel that sometimes hearing the words of the Buddhas and ancestors, I feel like it's a heart-to-heart meeting, right? They touch us. They're not just empty, old, dry words. Sometimes they may be seen that way, but sometimes it feels like we actually meet their Buddha nature through their words. That's the miracle of the Dharma, it seems. So does that address this? Well, Richard.
Just in hearing the idea of Buddha nature and that it is, at least it's implied that that's some constant, that is the vast unknown. That is the mystery. Well, in that understanding, does greed, hate, and delusion, for some unknown reason, arise at the same time that Buddha nature does?
Yes. Does seem that way, doesn't it?
Endlessly.
endlessly.
After that, you're going to say beginningless.
Beginningless, yeah. Well, that's what we say, beginningless greed, hate, and delusion.
So they arise together. There's a mystery.
Yeah, they arise together. We might say that, what's the relationship between them? We might say, from a certain perspective, greed, hate, and delusion are the obscuration to the Buddha nature. And from another perspective, we might say greed, hate, and delusion are manifestations of Buddha nature. Because where else could they come from? And I think both. They're manifestations of Buddha nature that appear to obscure Buddha nature. Isn't that amazing, actually?
It is amazing. You know, could you maybe say, like, now I'm starting to think of theater or something, could you say one couldn't arise without the other? You know, like, you'd have to have a hero and a villain. You know, otherwise you have no story, you know. And so somehow...
They only arise because they're present in your auric field.
That's not how I'm asking it.
I think that we could say that must they always go together? We might say, in terms of sentient beings, they always go together. But, you know, we do have stories of, like, Buddhas have removed the obscurations completely. So there's just Buddha... The classic story is, like, when Buddha, all the obscurations to Buddha nature, called greed, hate, and delusion, have been completely dropped away, and there's nothing left but Buddha nature, then, strictly speaking, it's not called Buddha nature anymore. It's called the Dharmakaya. It's called, like, complete Buddhahood. But so there is, that's one story about how you could say there could be Buddha nature without greed, hate, and delusion.
Then why isn't there? I mean, why wasn't there to begin with?
Well, you could say maybe there was to begin with. And then something happened. Exactly. Because in the beginning, nothing happened, right? Nothing happened. Nothing was happening.
Yeah.
And the universe was bored. And said, wouldn't this be interesting? Wouldn't it be interesting if something happened?
Yeah.
And in order for something to happen, we need greed, hate, and delusion. So that, you know, universal, vast, spacious emptiness, you know, how did this happen that it said, let's put on a show?
I'm so in line with what you're saying.
You know,
that's where the God particle came in.
The God particle, yeah.
It happened until this particular...
Yeah. Yeah, and all of it is just speculation, you know. We'll never know, right?
We'll never know. But it's the theater analogy.
Yeah. The theater, in Hinduism, it's, is it Leela? The dance, like the divine illusory dance, and Maya is like the display of the apparent universe is like this, you know, magical dream. And why? We cannot ask this. But here we are. We have to deal with it. We have to deal with it. What?
Or not.
And if not, then we're just, it's very painful, right?
Wasting space.
So then we have this issue of the self. We're studying the self and looking at the small illusory self that's that, you know, that was created, we don't know how. And then we say the big self, like Buddha nature, our true self is not really a self. And the small self is the obscuration to the big self, and the small self is a manifestation of the big self at the same time. So this small, you know, we get so confused within this small little one who I think I am. And it's interesting to look at the relationship of the small one to who we really are. So particularly for Richard today, who is a Zen Sufi, I have a Rumi poem about this. About the relationship of the independent self illusion, the I, that's the linchpin of samsara, and vast Buddha nature. This poem called Bestami, the name of a Sufi. That magnificent dervish, Bayezid Bestami, came to his disciples and said, I am God. It was night where it's pitch black and we don't distinguish the 10,000 things. It was night and he was drunk with his ecstasy. There is no God but me. You should worship me. At dawn, when he had returned to normal, they came and told him what he had said, that he was God. He said, if I say that again, bring your knives and plunge them into me. God is beyond the body, and I am in this body. So kill me if I say that again. That heresy. That I am God. So that's like his little self speaking the next day, right? Like, blasphemy. I said, I am God. And particularly, God is of Buddha nature, is beyond the body. I am in this body. Each student then sharpened his knife. And again, Bayezid drank the god wine. The sweet dessert knowing came. The inner dawn snuffed his candle. Reason, like a timid advisor, faded to a far corner as the sun sultan entered Bayezid. Pure spirit spoke through him. Bayezid was not there. The he of his personality dissolved. Like the Turk who spoke fluent Arabic, then came to and didn't know a word. Must be some other Sufi story. The light of God poured into the empty Bayezid and became words. Muhammad did not dictate the Quran. God did. The mystic osprey opened its wings in Bayezid and soared. Inside my robe there's nothing but God, he said. How long will you keep looking elsewhere? The disciples drew their knives and slashed out like assassins. But as they stabbed at their sheik, they did not cut Bayezid, they cut themselves. There was no mark on that adept. But the students were bleeding and dying. Those who somewhat held back, respecting their teacher, had only lightly wounded themselves. A selfless one disappears into existence and is safe there. She becomes a mirror. If you spit at it, you spit at your own face. If you see an ugly face there, it's yours. If you see Jesus and Mary and Buddha, they're you. Bayezid became nothing, that clear and empty. A saint puts your image before you. When I, Rumi, reach this point, I have to close my lips. Those of you who are love drunk on the edge of the roof, sit down or climb down. Every moment spent in union with the beloved is a dangerous delight, like standing on a roof edge. Be afraid up there of losing that connection and don't tell anybody about it. Keep your secret.
He never wrote one word down. Rumi never wrote one word. He never sat and wrote a word. It was all his scribe. He wrote what he said. He never wrote it.
He was spinning around.
He wasn't spinning. He was just talking to his teacher, to his students. Never wrote a word.
So we might have this, we might, like, you know, our disciples and ourselves might be having these conversations inside, saying, like, this painful, you know, deteriorating body sitting here is just a mess. This is not it. This is not Buddha. Far from it. And, you know, and then once in a while, maybe right in the midst of it, of this pile of pain, there's just some ease. There's a jewel in the center. But what about this, all this, this pile of karmic hindrances and all of this? If I say that this is Buddha, I deserve to die. So it's all from perspective. The little self says that, right? And then the inner knowing, when we become very patient and enthusiastic and open, then there's something that's completely fine. There's not a problem. And vow can help us. I think vow comes from, like, the small self in general, I think. Yes, even the way the Buddha said it in the sutra seemed like that. I, myself, for many years, like the beginning of every period of Zazen, or here we maybe, it gets tedious, there's too many periods, so I'll at least do it in block, and when we have a block of Zazen and we come back after a break, I'll make a vow, and I sit down, which has changed over the years how I do it, but it's like a direction to remember what I'm doing. So these days I'm just very generic, traditional words of, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I, like little me, takes refuge. I put my refuge in huge Buddha, boundless Buddha. Little me puts my, you know, finds complete security. I vow to find complete security in Buddha and the Buddha's teachings and those practicing the Buddha's teachings. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Vowing to realize awakening to benefit all beings. That's what I say. I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Vowing to realize awakening to benefit all beings. It's a little tricky because, you know, I don't think in Zen we don't want to get into vowing to realize awakening at some long point in the distant future. I vow to realize the awake mind right now, and I trust that this will be of benefit to beings. And then I usually within less than a minute I forget all about the vow, and I'm start thinking about the past and future. And then remember again. And then forget again. And remember again and forget again. It's right here, always, is never far away in the distant future. It's just a hair's breadth deviation. When we were chanting the Lotus Sutra this morning, the lines that jumped out at me, which, you know, lots of things in Sesshin, more and more things jump out at us, right? They jump out of the bushes when you're walking by the bushes. They jump out of the air when you're walking by the air. They jump out of the sutras when you're reading the sutras. Like, they're always jumping, but we're just more attentive. I just notice those lines. I heard them differently, where the Buddha says something like, in the great blaze at the end of the kalpa, when all is destroyed in the raging fire, my domain stays serene and calm. Ever filled with, you know, human and heavenly beings, where living beings delight and play. So I thought, oh, that sounds like Sesshin. Like this great blaze. these great blazing legs, back, and body. I don't know if anyone doesn't have a blazing body on the sixth day of sitting. But right in the midst of this raging firestorm, the Buddha's realm stays serene and calm, where living beings delight and play there, right in the midst of the fire. So I appreciated that line in a new way. I think that's maybe is kind of what he's talking about. So, you must be dying to know what happened to Kodo Sawaki Roshi. We didn't even bring his story, we didn't even get to yesterday.
We don't know what kind of a state he was in after 3 years.
Yeah, so for those who weren't here, we've been hearing the life and teachings of the enthusiastic practitioner of Zazen named Kodo Sawaki. And in our last episode, he didn't know where to go and practice. A friend of his had this abandoned temple. So he said, you can go stay there if you want. And, but no one, you know, no one really comes. I don't know how you practice there. And he said, perfect. So he went and, he said, for 3 years, he just sat Zazen and no one came. He says, which was most suitable to me. And he sat from 2 a.m. till 10 p.m. in an uninterrupted sesshin for 3 years by himself. Yeah, amazing. And when he's talking about this, he says, people may think that when you practice alone doing Zazen all the time like this, that everything will just go blank into just that your domain just stays serene and calm. But actually, the more you're alone, the more you eliminate things to do, the more things float to the surface like a crab blowing bubbles. I think he's struggled. This was not just ease and joy for 3 years, but he was totally devoted to, like, such trust in the Zazen that's doing nothing. I think I imagine from hearing his teachings too that he was a stubborn character. And I think that some of you might agree that I myself can be quite a stubborn character sometimes. And so I appreciate hearing about how he can put his stubbornness to work. Stubbornness can be like a blessing when it comes to maybe things like diligence, but it can be a great curse when it comes to things like flexibility. Yes. So maybe it was easier for him to just practice alone like this. But he said, I felt like a parrot attempting to put out a forest fire by soaking its wings and flying through the trees, sprinkling drops onto the forest fire. That's how that Zacchin, that 3-year Zacchin felt. So Waki had given up on finding people to practice with the intensity he thought necessary for one to really understand Dogen's way, which is why he decided to sit by himself at Jofukuji until, as he put it, he died. But his former teacher, Sotan Oka, had been asked to go to Daijiji to revive this old temple of the Soto school. And Sotan cajoled Sawaki into going there in his stead. He gave Sawaki the impression that it would be for about 6 months, but when half a year later Sawaki was ready to leave, Sotan pleaded with him to stay on. So he left his solitary temple and went to this other place where there were other people to practice with. And he said he wanted to leave, maybe go back, do another 3 years or something. But his teacher asked him to stay on. And he did stay there until his teacher's death some 6 years later. His solitary zazen was over, but he was fortunate to find students in that area who possessed the energy to practice, just the kind of practitioners he'd given up searching for in his 3-year retreat. And again, I think a little bit about, I'm reminded of this time I was at No Abode Hermitage, which was not quite alone. It wasn't quite a 3-year sesshin. But I had a little bit of feeling like a tiny group of people just practicing zazen almost all the time. And I was quite content there. It wasn't my choice to leave. It was my teacher said, can you come to this temple, Green Dragon Temple, down the road here, so I can bring some of my students to Tassajara with me. You know, they're working in the kitchen now, and I really like them to come with me to this practice period at Tassajara, but Green Gulch staff won't let me take them. Because we need the kitchen help. So you, Kokyo, come and help in the kitchen for just this practice period. And then you can go back to No Abode and continue to sit alone. Which, you know, I think he was supportive of you this is your vow. We'll see what happens. I support it for now. So my relationship with my teacher is, I have a hard time saying no if he makes a request. And I thought that would be good. So I did. I left No Abode after about 4 years and went to Green Gulch for 1 3-month practice period. But then that practice period ended, and causes and conditions were such that, you know, I was there, and other things were happening, and other offers were, you know, coming. Can you stay on here and help in this way? And, you know, I realized, yeah, this is what happens. And my years there at No Abode ended. I didn't go back.
Where was No Abode?
It's at 38 degrees latitude and 70. If you on a GPS, if you type in No Abode, it will point you exactly where it is. So it's wonderful to just respond, you know, to requests. I've much of my practice life has been that way, because I have a hard time making decisions, and I see that every decision I make is based on total delusion. So if at least somebody else's delusion can say, like, can you do this for me? Then it's kind of like, you know, okay, that's, you know, it's a better reason than mine. Sometimes it's tricky this way, you know. And this is my teacher's style too, you know. Just respond. Yeah, I think he tries to live that way. That's how, you know, one who's left home can just respond. You're not fixed anywhere. And I once told this to some other monks from different tradition. Yeah, my teacher says, you just, you know, as a monk, just respond to requests. And they said, that's insane. That sounds like completely opposite. You have to have your own totally determined vow never to be swayed by anyone. I thought that was interesting. You know, so I think there's both sides. You know, both sides. So at this time, Sawaki talked about being offered Inca. In Rinzai Zen, Inca means like, literally like seal of approval. Inka Shome is like seal of approval for the verification of awakening. So they, it's an acknowledgement of a kind of realization in Rinzai Zen, where they can say this is it and this is not it, and you passed this koan and you didn't pass this koan. Soto Zen, we don't get into that kind of thing so much, because practice and verification are not two. There's just endless practice. So this is the author of the book here saying, Inca, known as certification in American Zen circles, used by a Zen teacher to indicate that his disciple has realized enlightenment. In Orthodox Soto Zen, there is official transmission of the Dharma, but it's not ordinarily considered a certification of enlightenment. Dharma transmission is just the standard Soto Zen.
Is that what's happening here, Dharma transmission?
Yeah, it's happening constantly. As Dogen says, when you first start practice, you imagine that you first seek the way, you imagine you are far away from its environs, but Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You're immediately your original self, always. And then we also do have ceremonies where we fully enact a face-to-face transmission in Soto Zen, you know, at a particular time and place. So we have that too. So, but Inca is a little bit different. And I don't know if this was a Rinzai Zen teacher that was offered him this Inca. Well, exactly, it was this man here. But Sawaki turned this honor down. He said that if he had accepted it, he would no longer have been a free agent, traveling around the country and teaching where he pleased, and would instead be drawn inescapably into the politics of the Soto sect. He regarded Inca as proof of membership in a club, and though it would have qualified him to be the next abbot of Daidiji upon his teacher's death, he despised the whole system of Zen institutionalism and the contradictions inherent in it. Yeah. So he was a renegade, you know, and he never did have a temple, and he just, I mean, he did practice at these temples for a while, but later in his life, he just traveled constantly, leading sesshins all around.
Sounds like he never needed the security of a temple.
Yeah, he, exactly.
Or an institutional religion.
Yeah, he didn't need the security, yeah.
His security was his realization of the truth.
Yeah, and zazen. And his robe. He's got this poem about the Okesa where he says something like, a snail carries its home wherever it goes, and it dies in it. It's its shell. And he said, that's the monk's Okesa. That's your home. You live under that and you die under that. That's all you really need. At Daijiji, at this new place now, he found the kind of practitioners who renewed his faith in the possibility that Buddhist practice, in parentheses, which meant zazen to Sawaki, would return to Japan. Maybe he felt that Buddhist practice was lost in Japan. How wonderful to find people to practice zazen with. Look at this, room full of people practicing zazen all day long, some of us all week long. What a precious gift. What a devotion. A rare thing in this world.
What time frame did he know?
It was like about 1900. Oh, and he's 37 years old. He's getting to be 40 years old, and it's around turn of the century. Yeah.
So he was born in
1880. So it was
more like
1920.
Yeah.
He was thinking that Zen was already starting to fall apart.
Yeah. Well, I think already, for a long time, I think if he felt that wholehearted dedication to zazen as the source was the Buddha way, then even before his time, not that many people practiced zazen in the Zen school in Japan, interestingly. I mean, there's the monasteries, the training monasteries where they practice zazen. Even there, maybe they're more about learning the intricacies of ceremony, but they have some zazen as part of the ceremony. And then there's only 30 or so of those places in Japan. And then there's thousands of small village temples where there's generally no zazen. There's Zen temples, but they're just, they do funeral ceremonies and other things like a small parish church might be a kind of a social thing. So what we have in America here is very unusual and very precious, I think. Again, we're a place like this is really a blend between a Japanese Zen monastery and a Japanese small town temple. And there's this kind of blend, there's nothing like it in Japan. It's really beautiful, I think, actually, this kind of thing, there was this university in town there, and he's called the Fifth Higher School, and the students there apparently were the ones who were really into practicing with him. But I'm not sure if they were, like, when he talks about this, if these were mostly the university students, because there'd be no time for school with this description, because he says he established this rigorous schedule. They rose at 2 a.m., which, he'd already done this for 3 years, right? So he was used to it. We can try it.
Five periods of zazen before breakfast?
Yeah. It sounds like he said, yeah, we don't have to worry about sleep.
Well, David said, can't sleep.
Oh yeah, yes, it's zazen, yeah. So they did, they rose at 2 a.m. and they did zazen till 6 a.m. So that's 4 hours of zazen. And then they had morning service and breakfast. So just like Patrick said. They must have done like about five periods. And then from 8 to 9:30, Sawaki lectured on Buddhism. He'd give an hour and a half talk every day. At 11 o'clock, they went out begging. And from 1 to 2, they practiced chanting and studied the Buddhist precepts. For the rest of the day, in the afternoon, they cared for the temple grounds, mainly weeding, until nightfall. They had a late dinner and then went to bed. But of course, Sawaki stayed up until 11 or 12 studying Dharma before retiring for 2 or 3 hours of sleep. That was their daily life. Then they had sesshins. Sesshins were so demanding that one wonders about their purpose. The author says. When I hear this, I think, that's a good point, you know. If you, what's the purpose of this? They were held every month for 5 days. The schedule started as on normal days at 2 a.m. And then the zazen went on till midnight. Everyone did 30 minutes of walking meditation after each meal. Like Patrick was saying, they do it at shohakus, that's their break. From midnight to 2 a.m. and from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m., so there's these 2 hours at night and then 1 hour in the afternoon, they did zazen without the use of the kyosaku, the stick that wakes people up. So usually, like every period, pretty standard thing in a Japanese temple that someone carries the stick, and if people are dozing, you get whacked and woken up. So, but they had this 2 hours at night where actually the idea was that they kept sitting, they didn't lie down to sleep. But they wouldn't carry the stick. So if you're sitting like this, it's fine for those 2 hours. And same with this 1 hour in the afternoon. This is the practice called mensaku, which must mean like sitting without the stick for 2 hours and then 1 other hour. In other words, they did not lie down for the entire 5 days, and their only opportunity for sleep was in zazen sitting posture during the 3 hours of mensaku. One wonders about the purpose of such a thing. Yeah, but every month for 5 days. And we might think, that's absurd, I don't believe it really happened. But I think it's probably pretty rare, but I myself had this experience of a sesshin at the one place I know of in America that's similar to this, is City of 10,000 Buddhas up in Ukiah, Northern California. And there they have a 3-week sesshin every year in the winter. And it's basically like this schedule. It was like, what's that?
It starts on the 27th.
Yeah, it's in January. And they pick the coldest time and they never turn the heat on. Leave the doors open, and 3 weeks, and there's no days off, and it's not 2 a.m., but it's 3 a.m. till midnight, and they do 1 hour zazen periods, with 20 minute kinhin, like fast kinhin, fast or slow, and they have a dharma talk. And they only have one meal a day. And they just, that's what they do. But, you know, for me, this is the first sesshin that I did. I was totally oblivious. I had no idea what Zen was about. I was just like, I graduated from college and decided before I get on with my real life that I would practice Zen for a little while. Oh no. So
you see where this is going.
Yeah, so I was looking for a place where I didn't have any money is there some place where I can stay and work a little bit and practice? And they were very open. Quite, it was unusual there. at City of 10,000 Buddhas for someone to do this. But they're like, well, we're in special retreat, but I had to go to their kind of city center in San Francisco first and meet them, and they said, okay, we can see you want to practice, so you can come. We're in this retreat now. I'm like, well, what's a retreat? I had no idea.
They let you do it with having no sushin experience.
Yeah, they're just, yeah.
That's weird.
And they're just like, they were just open. I mean, here we say anyone can come. You don't have to have, you know, it's a little harder maybe. Same with the place I practice in Japan. They'd have kind of intense sessions, but anybody could just come. And people would struggle. And then they would, you know, they wouldn't do it again. Or the next time they'd do it again. But this time, I went. And they did give me a break because I was working some to support my stay. Was it the greatest blessing? I'm like, thank you for letting me work some, because I think I could get up a little bit later too. And but when I would see them, I had questions about it, because the senior monks there, I mean, I came like halfway through, so they'd already been going about 10 days, and they were like continuously nodding, like every period of zazen they were just sleeping. Because they would do those 3 hours, like you said, just sitting. They wouldn't go back to lie down, so they'd be continuously sitting. And it wasn't like samadhi, right? It was like, looked like torture. I mean, maybe sometimes there'd be times in the day when they would settle into it. But I questioned it as a kind of meditative, calm abiding and insight practice. I think it's too extreme, I felt. But I did feel, as I joined that session for like the last half of it, as the days went on, it would move me like to tears by the end of like the devotion. It's like, you could say total stupidity in one sense, and like, you're not getting anything out of this meditation-wise, but like, they were doing it. Like, what kind of devotion is that? What would make somebody do that? I think, yes.
Did you speak to any of the monks afterwards about their devotion, the efficacy of sitting for that long?
No, I don't think so much.
I mean,
yeah.
Maybe,
mm-hmm.
Whatever.
Yeah, like often a lot of them Chinese or Taiwanese, Asian, and at that time there were maybe like, I think it was like half Americans. This was like in the late 80s, I think. But now it's almost all Asians. Yeah.
It was just one. When I was there, it was just one young American, maybe 30 or 40 from the other country.
Yeah. Some of you might know Hung Shur, Reverend Hung Shur is the abbot at Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, and he's that lineage and lived there for many years. But they don't do that kind of practice in Berkeley. Anyway, I think it's something about faith that like we read. There's like we want to get to the bottom of this, and we're willing to completely let go of like any the concerns of the small self of like, well, actually, don't we need like a certain amount of sleep and like some basic things? It's like we're just like, it's some kind of letting go, whether it's zazen practice, I don't know. So Sawaki seemed to have found fellow practitioners whose seriousness matched his own. Some parishioners at this temple had a different view of what a temple should be. Can you imagine? This was just one of these small temples in Japan, where you would usually be doing funerals and stuff. I think it maybe wasn't even like one of the training monasteries, right? But he set this thing up, and he probably thought, this guy's insane. They wanted a place where they could go to socialize and perhaps have a drink with the priest. So when Kasuaki's teacher died in 1922, this group of parishioners, looking for an excuse to get rid of Sawaki, refused his proposal to make Kishizawa Ion the new abbot of Daijiji and to keep Sawaki as the resident teacher. Kishizawa was in Sawaki's lineage and would have found no difficulty keeping Sawaki there if he were chosen as the new abbot. Sawaki left Daijiji when his proposal was rejected and moved to a small house in Kumamoto lent to him by a friend. That is interesting. Kishizawa Ion was a student of Sawaki's teacher, Ota Sokan. Kishizawa Ion was a teacher of Suzuki Roshi. He was like the Shobogenzo teacher of Suzuki Roshi. He lived in the same town as Suzuki Roshi, and Suzuki would go to visit him like every week for Shobogenzo studies. Yes.
So when you are in Japan and you describe to people there the kind of temple we have here, what do they make of it? You describe it as being very different than the parish.
Yeah.
Or even if you go to big temples where they do training and talk about all the zazen we do.
I think it's mixed, you know. I think the generally the ones I talk to are the Japanese priests that come to America, actually. Since I've come back from Japan, and generally like at Tassajara, there's usually often at least one young priest from one Eheiji or one of those places that Soto School sends over to check us out, and. And they're the ones, and they choose to come, so they're the ones who are curious about America, and they love it. They often maybe don't see places like this. They see Tassajara and Green Gulch, and they maybe come to visit places like this sometimes. And they know about them, I think. And I think they really, they're like, this is what we need in Japan. Those people, the ones who are already open and interested and come. And some of them, even stay for some years and go back to Japan. I know I'm thinking of one young man in particular who then they're generally like are going to inherit a temple over there, and then they make it a little bit like this. They model it like basically they have zazen. They have like a daily zazen for lay people in their town, and inspired by America. So I think the ones who come are like that. The ones who don't come have their biased view and think, well, you know, if you're not Japanese, how could you even practice then? Sometimes, like.
My first summer at Tassajara, there was one of these, a 19-year-old priest whose father was a priest at Haiti, and he was like royalty kind of guy. And somehow I became like the liaison guy, so we hung out together and worked out together and taught me judo. We were together all summer. And this was a wonderful guy. I just loved this guy, you know. And was direct to them. And some part of the way through the practice period, he had to leave. And so three of us drove out and she said, so what do you think of our practice? And this has always been an interesting question, whether either Mayer or I understood, but he said something, a Japanese word that she said meant it's empty. Not in a good way. Like you guys aren't getting it. You're walking around, parroting. But I never really quite, because it was a word I didn't understand, ever heard, and I don't know if May was getting the translation right or not, but that's what she and I thought he meant. It was lacking.
So it could be, yeah. I mean, I think everyone's going to have a different idea, right? Everyone's going to have different views, and because it's definitely different what we're doing in America and Japan in many ways. And I think both have their pros and cons, right? So, but it's something unique that we're doing here. I think very beautiful and inspiring experiment that we're trying. And I think, you know, in many ways it's working. We could maybe see ways in which it's not working, but... some of these university students who tended to be the ones who would come and practice with him, one day some of them came to me, Sawaki, and asked, Osho, why do you do Zazen? I said, Zazen is of no use. I just do it. They were surprised at my answer, and I wondered whether it would have an effect on them. What a candid priest! They said, you know, our school teachers never talk that way. They always say there's a reason to do everything. Grumbling like that, they returned home. Then one day they appeared again. Osho, we've come to join you in something of no use. From then on, they practiced Zazen. So he was living in this house nearby, but eventually he ran out of money. And but somebody who liked his chanting voice, a wealthy man in the town, said, you can stay in my country home here on top of a mountain. I think of Coben, you know, who like seemed like sort of lived this way, right? He'd go where people invited him, and I think eventually people offered him houses. Didn't he have like a Japanese farmhouse somewhere?
Oh, in Santa Cruz?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Hollis's. Yeah. Yeah. And then in Taos too, I think, you know.
Yeah, Taos, somebody started building a house.
Hmm.
Turned out to be a disaster.
A disaster. Because he'd keep moving around too.
Yeah, I can't remember what had happened, but he was having a hard time during it.
The founder here, yeah, yeah. So basically, that house became kind of like his home base. But then he traveled around the country, lecturing and holding sesshins for the next 13 years. His moving temple, but it doesn't. And what Angie has, the floating zendo,
right.
maybe inspired by this a little bit. Or, you know, similar sort of spirit of like, we don't need a place so much, we just need people to come and sit.
Senzaki Roshi also.
Oh, yeah, floating zendo.
Floating zendo.
Oh, okay.
What's a floating zendo?
Means like, yeah, no special temple, no special location.
But he held them in temples, though, right?
It doesn't say, but I imagine, yeah, because there's Zen temples everywhere over there. But maybe other places, maybe people's houses, I don't know. And then, you know, so that's what he did for many years. And then later, when he was 55, he started teaching at Komazawa University, which is the Soto Zen scholastic university in Japan, and became the overseer of practice at Sojiji. So the main head monastery of the school. So in his later years, he became more mainstream and established another sitting group and eventually went to Antaiji and died at 85.
Isn't it unusual for Zen to be taught in scholastic school? Was that different than Japan?
Yeah, you know, it's a separate teaching outside the scriptures, we say, of Zen. So it's kind of, there's an interesting part in here about that point.
Part of religious
belief? He says, There's lots of Zen teachings, and in fact, in the Chinese canon of all the different schools of Buddhism, the largest section is on Zen. So there's a lot of teachings, and it's based on the sutras. So there's always been people who are scholar practitioners in Zen, and then there's people who are just like kind of yogi practitioners and just sit. And Suwaki is kind of an interesting blend because he did all of his Yogacara studies, and then later he went to be a professor. But he was really into it. I think in the 3 years, it almost sounds like he was just sitting. So both sides are good, I think, depending on personal inclinations. I think if people are drawn to intricate clarification of the teachings conceptually, then I think that can be super valuable. All these teachers have given these teachings for that reason. And for those who have great faith in Zazen itself, apart from words and letters, that's good. But there's one of the other stories in here was about somebody else who was a student of Suwaki was kind of sort of making fun of him, teasing him a little bit for being a scholar, and because like in the later like Antaiji style, they kind of made fun of Zen scholars. And I think the current Antaiji in Japan is just like, they just sit, you know. And like, you don't need all these words and complicated teachings. But they said actually, and Suwaki, part of the problem was he'd like to move around a lot. But when they'd say, why don't you leave that and come over here? He'd say, well, I'd really like to, but I have this huge collection of books and I can't travel with it. And I had this smile when I heard that because I've had this problem. Myself. I don't have much else, but I have this huge pile of Dharma books that just keeps growing. And I use them regularly too. So I feel like, you know, if I were to like travel for an extended time, I'd have to either like give them away or like put them in storage and pay for it or something. So it's kind of it's a burden to have a bunch of stuff. Even if it's like great Dharma stuff. And Suwaki seems to have that same problem. When one time he was like, come over here. And he's like, I have all these books. I don't travel light. So this is to you, teachings of Suwaki Roshi. To you who does everything you can to get enlightenment. This section, Satori, often translated as enlightenment, but means like realization or understanding. Let's say realization. So he says, we don't practice in order to get realization. It's realization that pulls our practice. We practice being dragged around by realization. You don't seek the way seeks you. Now, this is a really great one. He sometimes comes up with these real gems. Wanting to become a Buddha through Zazen is like somebody who's taking the train home and because he wants to get home as soon as possible, starts to run inside the train. It's such a great image, right? The train's carrying us always, right? Buddha nature is carrying us. Wanting to become a Buddha through Zazen is like somebody who's taking the train home. And because he wants to get home faster, as soon as possible, he starts to run inside the train. Instead of just sitting down in the train and let it carry us. Yeah. This is a great image. Here we are in Sesshin, but we want to get there faster, so internally we're maybe like running ahead of ourselves. Yeah, we get ahead of ourselves. Yeah, how's it something in the future? something in the future. Dropping off body and mind means that individual practice and individual realization disappear. It seems there are some who try to put the Buddha Dharma to work for people. The same way everyone these days is interested in self-improvement, they're trying to improve themselves with their practice and get realization. Yet it's clear that there can't be any dropping off of body and mind as long as we don't give up this human ambition.
I have the ambition just to have a little tiny bit more peace.
I don't know exactly what... intention, I think, and aspiration and vow, we not only can have, but we need. Ambition, we'd have to maybe look up in a dictionary, but my teacher once said, when asked about leaving home, about ordination as a priest, he said, a priest... should have no worldly ambitions. And somebody maybe even said, does that mean that you can't have like a career or something? He's like, no, it's fine. You could have a career, but it not as an ambition. Like, you can do basically anything, but if it's an ambition to kind of like get somewhere and improve yourself and your situation somehow, and it's tricky because the Buddha way can become an ambition easily. It becomes a worldly ambition.
Yeah.
Enlightenment can easily become a worldly ambition.
Yeah, but the more you travel that, if you have ambition to start with, the more you travel it, the more desirous you become.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think you could say it's a kind of contrived thing to put ourselves into a practice that leads to total uncontrivedness.
That is fake it until you make it.
Fake it till you make it. Yeah, in a way. One of those little cards that I almost brought, and that pile of cards, this Tibetan teacher, Sogni Rinpoche, said, if you're not sure if you're in this like non-dual naked awareness or not, fake it.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really interesting advice. Fake it.
Uh-huh.
If you're not sure whether you are or not, fake it. Because
yeah.
It's almost like a Zen koan, because you can say, fake it? Well, isn't that just totally contrived? That's not it. Just pretend you're in it. But there's something more profound.
I said, I don't think I can really be a psychiatrist. And he said, just keep pretending it.
Yeah.
Later,
so if you want to be Buddha, just fake it. Just pretend you are. But really wholeheartedly.
Well, we are.
Well,
not realized.
So that's why if we fake it, we think we're faking it, but actually. So it's getting so late. But the next section here is called, to you who are complaining all the time that you haven't got any time. So maybe just, is it okay to feel a little bit more? People only keep themselves busy to avoid boredom. I do that. Because I live in this room completely surrounded by Dharma books, it's really hard to do zazen in there.
Because I like to do what?
To do zazen, to just sit there, because there's like these like gems, these jewels of like Buddha's words are like calling me from all directions. So I'm like, this is zazen, but I could pick this. Whoa. And it's often like that, right? But that's a kind of busy to be like studying all the time, right? But it's kind of a little bit more boring to just sit there when I could be like reading all those books. People keep themselves busy to avoid boredom. Everyone complains that they're so busy they haven't got any time. But why are they so busy? It's only their illusions that keep them busy. A person who practices Zazen has time. When you practice Zazen, you have more time than anyone else in the world.
Yeah, because eventually your concept, your mental concept goes outside time, and you live in a timeless zone.
Yeah, time becomes a different issue. Yeah. But, you know, this is a really, I appreciate this section a lot because I'm someone who actually feels like really busy a lot of the time. And you might say, well, if Kokyo, who's just, his job is to sit zazen and like study a little bit and stuff, if he feels so busy all the time, what hope do we even have? It's a difficult issue, this busy thing. It's amazing. Time goes so quickly. Even the Sashin is quickly passing. Yes.
This reminded me of something very nice I read about how for Americans today, busy is our term for virtue. So, how are you? Oh, I'm so busy. And so you're wasting blessed and virtuous and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And we refer to important people.
Taking care of business.
And if someone doesn't pay you the kind of attention that you feel you deserve, you sort of give an excuse for that by saying, well, I know that they're really busy. So we have this sort of virtue language that we put on all of our actions all the time. It creates this feeling of us that we're really busy, even though it's often a rehearsal of a certain kind of virtue and moral standing onto things. So.
I think it's probably always been the case, but maybe more so in the last 20 years in America. I think this is like a really big in our culture now.
It's become a language we use to talk about all kinds of different things and shapes our experience of time.
And maybe the part of why we feel maybe comfortable being busy is we feel like we're productive and we're helping. And it is good, you know. So we might question, well, just sit zazen all the time. Well, what about the suffering people all around us? What if our busyness is helping them? But we might question, is our busyness helping them? Helping them is good in any way we can. But if we're getting busy helping, and they, like stressed, helping people become free and happy, then it's nice to step back and look, check. Or like that, is it a bumper sticker or something like, it's good for everybody to do Zazen for half an hour a day, unless they're too busy, in which case, an hour a day. If you aren't careful, you'll start making a big fuss just to feed yourselves. You're constantly in a hurry, but why? Just to feed yourself. Chickens, too, are in a hurry when they peck at their food. But why? Only to be eaten by humans. So, you know, I think our busyness is not just to feed ourselves sometimes. It's to help others, right? I think so there's value in that. But again, it's good to look at. Is it just, well, we need to, you know, I need to support myself with a certain amount of income. But he brings it right down to home. It's like, just to feed you. If you have enough to eat and, you know, a roof or an umbrella or something.
The Tenzo just sent me a message to say that he's busy in the kitchen and if we don't stop, his food will be cold.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's busy. It is getting pretty late.
Busy.
And,
how did you get that message?
She channeled it.
That's why she's the email.
To you who are complaining you haven't got enough time.
what was the first chapter called again? To you who are afraid of what other people
think. Yeah, of what other people think of you. How others see you. Time, it's like we, you know, it just keeps going. It is, totally.
You have somebody in this corner, you know, 16 hours a day making sure.
Yeah, it's totally structured around time. And I remember saying on maybe the first day, thinking like, you know, we might start thinking that this is the first half day out of 14 half days of sitting. And but just wait how quick they'll go. Now we're on the 12th.
That's called psychological time. There's different kinds of time.
Yeah. And this is the time for lunch.
Yeah.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.